Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning.
Hello.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio from Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded ancestral territory of the Halkamilamen Squamish-speaking peoples. My name is Jesse. Happy to be here with you this hour, where I am going to be sharing a long interview from one of our intrepid public affairs department members, Tanya. This one with SFU's own Samir Gandesha about fascism, populism, and Zionism, other isms. This is recorded last year, but unfortunately, I guess, still very relevant and worth listening to. So that's going to take up almost, well, it's 57 minutes long. So that's going to be the show today. I'll pop back in at the end to say goodbye. But for now, enjoy this interview.
My name is Samir Gandesha, and I'm professor of global humanities. I've been here at SFU since 2003, and I specialize in critical theory. I've done work on populism, fascism, and aesthetic.
Okay, I guess my first question would be, with the rise of populism in the world, primarily in like North America with Trump and Canada to an extent, and Europe's far right, that includes Marie Le Pen's National Rally, Giorgia Meloni's Brothers of Italy, Germany's AfD, and Britain's Reform UK, where do we like draw the line between the end of populism and the rise of authoritarianism?
This is a very important question. Before I move on to talk about authoritarianism, I think it's important to distinguish between, let's say, left and right forms of populism. So you've described our forms of right-wing populism, which in and of themselves tend to be authoritarian insofar as their definition of the people tends to be exclusionary, and their definition of the enemy as well tends to be personalizing, right? So a very important trope is kind of a kind of globalist conspiracy, and you only have to scratch below the surface of that to discover anti-Semitism. And this became clear in the Unite the Right rally in 2017, where you have this sort of torchlit march with the chanting of Jews will not replace us.
Yeah, that's where the infamous Nick Fuentes actually got his rise,
exactly.
I believe.
Yeah, that's right. And he's clearly anti-Semitic. And so there's also a connection there with this great replacement theory.
Yeah.
Right? Very much at the heart of contemporary authoritarian or right-wing populism is a profound demographic anxiety that migration, particularly migration from Muslim countries, is overwhelming the West and is making the European or the white settler colonialists, you could say, in North America, a minority in his own country, and it really is his. There's a very strong masculine dimension to this.
Mm-hmm.
So right populism, authoritarian populism, tends to define the people in this kind of ethno-nationalist way, whereas we've had with figures like Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn, Podemos, and others, and now you could say Zoran Mamdani, who just won the Democratic primary for the mayoralty of New York City, you have a kind of left populism, and left populism is really about understanding society as based on class division, admittedly a kind of amorphous class division, not a, a very clear sense of, you know, the working class versus the bourgeoisie, but rather a notion of, you know, the 99 versus the 1%. It's mm-hmm. something that Bernie Sanders has emphasized, something that Jeremy Corbyn has emphasized. And so here you have, rather than a personalizing definition of the enemy, so to speak, there's a kind of class dimension that resists defining the, or understanding the ills of society as attributable to an ethnic group or several ethnic groups. And this is important because there is an attempt to remain within a kind of liberal democratic framework. In a sense, trying to make democracy live up to its own promises, to make democracy, you know, in a sense, to democratize democracy and to make it more egalitarian, which is really the fundamental premise of democracy. If there's great inequalities in a society that considers itself to be liberal and democratic, it effectively cannot be. And mm-hmm. we see this with the rule of money in politics today. Mm-hmm. So the second part is then, where does populism start to become authoritarian? Well, when populist movements capture state power and claim to rule in the name of the people, while at the same time undermining representative institutions, by undermining the rule of law, by going against both the letter and the spirit of the constitutional frameworks of their societies, then you have a sharp turn in the direction of authoritarianism. But one can see how this might work insofar as, you know, democracies are, you know, literally the rule of the people. Mm-hmm. Right? And if you have somebody like Trump coming along, or somebody like Maloney or Marine Le Pen claiming to embody the will of the people, as certain dictators in the 20th century claim to do, then they feel that they can circumvent the checks and balances on executive power, mm-hmm. right? And still, in a way, call themselves democracies, because they're ruling in the name of the people. Mm-hmm. And this is, in a sense, what both Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin have called post-liberal democracy. Liberal democracy is precisely democratic rule with very clearly delimited limitations on executive power. Mm-hmm. And I should note that, you know, you've given these examples of the United States certain European societies, but under Stephen Harper's majority government from 2011 to 2015, he was in the process of centralizing power in the PMO, mm-hmm. challenging the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. And also muzzling federal government librarians and scientists, particularly scientists who were speaking out about the effects of his project to turn Canada into a global energy superpower, mm-hmm. the effects of that on the environment, climate change, mm-hmm. The anti-terror legislation, the Fair Voting Act, all of these were moving Canada in the direction of authoritarianism. It's no surprise that he's a big admirer of both Netanyahu in Israel, an admirer and friend of Netanyahu in Israel, but also Viktor Orban. And Viktor Orban has done very similar things in Hungary. Mm-hmm. So this should be a bit of a, you know, a wake-up call insofar as some of the tendencies towards authoritarianism globally actually had a kind of trial run here under Stephen Harper. Mm. And this is something we should not kid ourselves about. And even I would just add, as a kind of final note. In the attempt to putatively challenge the authoritarianism of Donald Trump and all this talk about Canada becoming the 51st state, etc., the rhetoric of elbows up with this new Carney government, you see a decided move in the direction of authoritarianism there with Bill C-2 and Bill C-5. Mm-hmm. So we should be wary of these developments.
What distinguishes Europe's populism from Trump's populism? Because, like, to me, they kind of seem like the same. Like, are they similar, or is there like some differences?
This is a huge question, and I would be very wary of generalizing across Europe. These are different societies with different political traditions and different experiences in the 20th century. So I am wary. So just say a few things about this. I think you're right to notice some similarities. And indeed, one of the things that sort of picks up with from my, you know, my previous remarks a second ago is the influence of Viktor Orban, who's impressed a lot of Republicans. He's impressed people like Tucker Carlson, right?
Yeah.
And so there is a kind of two-way street here, whereas, a lot of European far-right parties and movements are being influenced by Trumpism, the Trumpians and the Republican Party and far-right commentators are learning from certain European examples, so Orban, but also you'll recall when Elon Musk made an appearance at an ADF conference just prior to the last election, and cheering on that party,
mm-hmm.
And saying, you know, you should no longer be, or you shouldn't be embarrassed to be Germans, be proud Germans. Well, that's a very loaded thing to say,
yeah.
Given this memory culture in Germany, which has its own problems, which we may come to discuss. But also, J.D. Vance was given to, I mean, he did go and lecture Germany on its tenuous support of free speech, which is a bit ironic given the clampdown on free speech and academic freedom when it comes to pro-Palestine voices, both on U.S. University campuses and off of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's an interesting sort of a set of connections there, but I'd also say that, you know, U.S. has, since its founding, right, as the New Jerusalem or the Bright City on the Hill, has emphasized its exceptionalism, and this is something we really should think about. It is the global hegemon, which is now being rapidly challenged by China and the BRICS in a kind of larger sense, but it's still that, you know, the last remaining global hegemon after the dismantling of the Soviet Union. And central to that is the fact that the U.S. greenback serves as a global reserve currency, which gives the United States a lot of advantages. It also leads to trade imbalances, which now Trump is seeking somewhat quixotically to address by these tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that has to figure here. And one of the dimensions of this exceptionalism is that in the United States, as opposed to European societies, especially like France and Italy, there's a very strong libertarian dimension to the far right,
mm-hmm.
whereas I would say that in the European far right, there's a much stronger tradition of collectivism and a much stronger tradition of ethnic identity around language and shared historical meanings and experiences. Mm-hmm. Whereas the United States doesn't have that, and I think this has created something of a question as to what is U.S. identity. It had been a kind of melting pot and so on, mm-hmm. but this is now being reversed, and it's starting to look more and more like white nationalism, mm-hmm. which points back to the fissure of the Civil War, and mm-hmm. in a sense the unsettled mm-hmm. past. That this maybe the Civil War wasn't quite didn't quite end. Mm-hmm. It went dormant, and maybe it's emerging once again.
Mm-hmm. Well, there has been a resurgence of fascist rhetoric. For example, recently, have you heard of the YouTube channel Jubilee?
I have heard of it. Yeah.
Okay, so there was like this guy, his name was Mehdi Hassan. He interviewed a couple of like far right conservatives, and one guy stood out to me. He called himself a fascist. He said that he wanted to live in autocracy. So this is like a resurgence of fascist rhetoric being allowed on mainstream media. So from this to Nick Fuentes like praising Hitler any chance he gets to, anytime like he returns on Twitter, he does that. To Europe's far-right parties like flirting with fascist nostalgia, such as the AfD has downplayed Germany's past with incorporating historical revisionism. And one of their members, I think his name is Bjorn Höcke, used two banned slogans in Germany, and also like quoted by saying that Germany needs to have like some kind of 180 degree turnaround in how it remembers its history. So with all of this, how would you assess these movements, and like do they like genuinely revive fascism or merely just adopt its aesthetics?
That's a fantastic question. I think that it is, again, a question that has to be posed in the specific contexts of the European societies themselves, right? So to talk about the experiences of Poland on the one hand and the experiences of Germany on the other, these are quite different things. And the rise, the return of, say, quasi-fascist, neo-fascist, post-fascist movements and parties has to be addressed in each context. Mm-hmm. So I think a key dimension of understanding the resurgence of fascism in Germany is precisely a revision of the memory culture and really the history of Germany in the 20th century. And I think that picks up a very interesting thread, which could, in a sense, be said in part to be generalizable both in the United States and other European societies. And that is that we have to remember that the memory culture in Germany, in West Germany, starting from, West Germany was founded in 1949, the memory culture, as we call it today, didn't start with the founding of the Federal Republic. It actually starts with the students' movement in the late 1960s. And I think this decade between 1967 and 1977 is absolutely crucial, within which the German student movement radicalized quite rapidly. And in that context, the question was raised, Father, what did you do during the war? And it sparked this important discussion. And this was on the backdrop of American bombers flying sorties out of places, I think, like Heidelberg, to carpet bomb Vietnam mm-hmm. and Cambodia. And so the students were drawing connections between their present mm-hmm. and the country's past. Right. So it was really the 60s that brought into, it was in the 60s, the generation of 68, that put into place this memory culture. And that is what the AFDE is seeking to undo. Mm-hmm. And in the sense, it's kind of if the 60s was a kind of revolutionary time, if we didn't actually have a revolution, it was a revolutionary time, and the far right in the global north is very aggressively trying to exert a kind of counter-revolutionary force. So in Germany, the rethinking, revision, revocation of this memory culture. In the United States, the reversal of the enormous gains of the civil rights movement, which now crystallizes as DEI or whatever you want to call it, diversity, equity, inclusion, yeah. Right? So that's being systematically dismantled. Mm-hmm. You have increasing restrictions on voting rights, gerrymandering, etc. Right. Yeah. So I think this might be a thread to pull through all of these societies in which there is a profound reaction to the, let's say, institutionalization of the gains of the 1960s, and this is what was called by one of the key student leaders in West Germany, the long march through the institutions, right? Mm-hmm. That we will take power by entering the institutions and transforming them from within, and on the other side lies revolutionary change. Mm-hmm. So this is a reversal of that. And I think this points to something also that's very important that shared far right in Europe, and something that the far right in the United States really admires. And that is an attack on wokeness, mm-hmm. right? And a resurgence of traditional values, mm-hmm. particularly traditional gender roles, a direct assault on LGBTQ plus rights, and so forth. So this is why the Republican right and you know the far right outside of the Republican Party really admires figures like Viktor Orban and Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. So I think this is something to really think more about, this attack on wokeness.
Mm-hmm. With these developments and the resurgence of fascism, can we like compare this to the 20th century, or is that like an overreach?
We can compare elements of this with the 20th century developments, 20th century fascism, and the forms of capitalist crisis that one could argue helped to produce these movements. And I mean, I talk about this in the introduction to Spectres of Fascism, and that's why I really call fascism a kind of specter. There's a ghost of fascism that's haunting us, but it's not the return of that phenomenon that we saw in the 1920s and 30s in Europe. And a key aspect of that is that we don't have today a revolutionary working class movement that's actually challenging the very integrity of capitalist society. Mm-hmm. And that is why fascism as a kind of mobilizing ideology and movement, which drew on some aspects of, you know, let's say, proletarian imagery and you could say aesthetics to some extent, mm-hmm. It took the shape that it did. Mm-hmm. We don't have that today because the threat to capitalism is of a different nature. So for the revolutionary working class, you substitute what the right calls wokeness or wokeism. Yeah. And I think that gives you quite a different sort of far right than in the 1930s and last century. That's redundant. The 1930s. Also, we should keep in mind the incredible splits within the far right, especially in the United States. So you have sort of straightforward populists like Steve Bannon, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Very different from, and you can see this in the tensions with Elon Musk, who is now, of course, out of the picture. But there are other so-called tech bros who are still very much front and center in this administration, if nonetheless playing a role behind the curtain. I mean, figures like Peter Thiel. Peter Thiel, Curtis Yarvin, a guy called Nick Land, who's a somewhat prominent philosopher in the UK for a couple of decades, is now living in China. He's a theorist of accelerationism. These figures are coming to prominence and have played an important role in saying we have today a contradiction between liberalism and democracy, so capitalism essentially, and democracy. So one of the two has to go. It's democracy. Mm-hmm. So Yarvin and Thiel both argue for a kind of autocracy, kind of a new form of monarchism that Yarvin theorizes as a society that's turned into a giant corporation, mm-hmm. at the head of which is a CEO. Mm-hmm. So I think this is, in a sense, the total capture of politics by neoliberal economics. And so this is the new fascism today. Mm-hmm. It's quite different from, again, the fascism of the previous century. Mm.
Both the United States and Europe engage in identity politics, as it has become like a lightning rod in public discourse. And critics claim that it fragments national unity, while supporters state it's essential for equity. Do you agree or disagree?
I think this is a fascinating question. Again, like all of your questions, they're really important ones. I actually delivered a lecture in the UK almost 2 years ago. It was a Julian Rose Memorial Lecture, in which I posed the question, is identity politics a dialectic of liberation, hence pursuing equity, mm-hmm. or is it what I call, following Jolene Rose, a paradox of empowerment? Mm-hmm. And I say, well, it's both. Identity politics starts out in the struggle for national liberation from European colonialism, sort of in the global south. And part and parcel of colonialism is the destruction of endogenous cultures and therefore, relatedly, identities. Mm-hmm. Right. So at an early stage of liberation, these movements grasped for those identities that had been repressed or even destroyed, and they sought to reinvent them and, mm-hmm. and revive them. This was very much part of the dialectic of liberation. But at the same time, those identities became available for the new elites to use against their own people. That's mm-hmm. the paradox of empowerment, right? The paradox of empowerment means essentially that you have different identities being recognized, but those who, in a sense, are subsumed beneath these identity categories find themselves disempowered, right? Mm-hmm. Because with those identities come very strict norms of how to be and how to act and how to engage in politics. So it can be a real mechanism of control. Mm-hmm. So I argue essentially that it's both, but we can understand the two in a historical sense. In terms of its ability outside of a national liberation struggle, it's identity politics' ability to offer a real alternative. I think it has failed miserably, and the fact that there has been